Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Some members of the American public are receiving a second COVID vaccine today, and we will talk a little bit about that later on. But I also want to talk, first up, we're going to hear about the Environmental Protection Agency, which in October approved the use of phosphogypsum in road construction. It's a waste product of phosphate mining. It contains small amounts of radioactive isotopes of radium and uranium. And on Friday, a coalition of public health, environmental, and union groups sued the EPA for approving phosphogypsum in roads. And that's what we're going to talk about first here. Let me give out the telephone number in case you want to join the conversation. 813-239-9663. You can email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. One of the groups that's suing the EPA is the Center for Biological Diversity, and their Florida director and senior attorney, Jacqueline Lopez, is joining us now by Zoom. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday, Jacqueline.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you can join us. So let's start with, first of all, what is phosphogypsum?
Phosphogypsum is the radioactive waste that is created when phosphate ore, which is mined here in Florida, gets turned into phosphoric acid, which is predominantly used for fertilizer. So it's the product, well, it's not really a product, but it is the outcome of applying the sulfuric acid to the phosphoric, the phosphate ore that gets mined. And the result is this radioactive waste that is then stored in piles, principally because the radioactive waste puts off radon, and the EPA has determined that the best thing we can do once we have this waste is to keep it concentrated in the stacks and try to mitigate the radon that off gases from them.
So far, you've used words like stacks and piles, but to people who live in the Tampa Bay area, they kind of look like giant mountains. So where is this phosphate waste stored, and what's its ties to the phosphate industry?
Thanks for pointing out how potentially misleading stack and pile can be. Really, they are mountains. They're hundreds of acres wide and hundreds of feet tall. And in fact, I grew up in the Tampa area, and there's the Riverview Gyp Stack, for example, which is right off of US 41, right there on the west side of the road. Well, actually, there's one on the west side and the east side now. And if you didn't know better, you'd think maybe it was a municipal landfill, because all you can see from the road is just this giant berm that goes up. From the air, it's much more impressive to see these towering stacks. The connection to the fertilizer industry is that the majority of the phosphate that is mined, at least in Florida, goes toward creating phosphoric acid, which is used in fertilizer. So the majority of the mining that we see in Florida, which is mostly in the interior of Polk County, Hillsborough, Hardy, down south to DeSoto, all of that, or the majority of that, goes to these fertilizer plants, which are next to the phosphogypsum stack. So the one at US 41, there's a few others. There's the New Wales Gyp Stack. Actually, throughout Florida, we have about 25 stacks that store about 1 billion tons of this radioactive waste. And once the phosphate that's mined gets processed and taken to the fertilizer plant where the sulfuric acid is applied, the waste is kept on site virtually in these stacks. And so we have the legacy of the fertilizer industry here with us in Florida. Florida has the densest concentration of this waste, but we're not the only state. Louisiana has a stack, and in fact, the stack at St. James Parish made the news about a year or so ago, because it was actually moving. It was sliding, and a nearby farmer noticed that. And the state Environmental Protection Agency there was scrambling to figure out what to do with this, because they're very heavy, they're very large, and when there's a problem, it's a significant problem for the community around them. There's also stacks in North Carolina, Mississippi, and further out west, but by far, Florida has the most of them.
We're speaking with Jacqueline Lopez, who is with the Center for Biological Diversity. She's their Florida director and senior attorney. And speaking of these stacks in Florida, one of the ones that you mentioned was in New Wales. People will remember that from four or so years ago, when a giant sinkhole formed at the top of this stack, and all of the water, or almost all of the water that was being stored in that stack, drained probably down into our drinking water aquifer. So what else should people know about that if they barely remember that story, or if maybe they haven't heard of that story? What should people know about that accident?
Yeah, that was in September of 2016. And one of the more alarming things was that the sinkhole happened inside of this gyp stack, and the public didn't learn about it for, I think it was almost 2 weeks. So there was a significant lag between the company that owns it, the government that regulates it, and then the public that lives nearby was notified. Another thing that we learned after that sinkhole was through an open records request that there had been several other similar incidents just in that one fossil gypsum stack. So perhaps that's an indication that that particular stack has issues, or perhaps that other gypsum stacks might be similarly vulnerable. There was another sinkhole, I think it was in 1994, at a fossil gypsum stack further north in Florida. So that would seem to suggest that the idea of storing that volume of acidic radioactive waste can be problematic when we have like our limestone base and the potential for that erosion, that sinkhole action to then enter, as you mentioned, the aquifer or the well water down below.
Our guest is Jacqueline Lopez, Center for Biological Diversity. Their Florida director and senior attorney, Jacqueline Lopez, is joining us here on WMNF's Midpoint Monday. It's 12:12 in the afternoon, and you're listening to 88.5 FM. My name is Sean Canaan. You were talking about the waste. This liquid waste is radioactive. So what makes it radioactive? Why would there, I mean, we don't think of this byproduct from Florida soil as being radioactive. So what makes it radioactive?
Along with the phosphate ore, which is the target of the mining, there's uranium, there's radium-226, and so there's polonium, there's other things that have radioactive properties that are naturally occurring and found in the ground. When the phosphate itself is mined and then processed, some of that radioactive elements are bound up in that process. And my understanding is that in the process of creating the phosphoric acid and applying that sulfuric acid, it makes the radioactive properties even that much more, it enhances the risk of those radioactive properties. Now, once it's stored in its solid form and begins to break down, that's when it releases the radon and becomes a clean air issue or a pollutant exposure issue through the air. And that has to do with the most recent litigation that we filed, why that comes under the Environmental Protection Agency's purview as monitoring or requiring these mitigation measures to address hazardous air pollutants. So actually, our phosphogypsum is stored and regulated that way because of the breakdown of the radium-226 principally and the radon that it emits.
And so just to remind people, in October, the Environmental Protection Agency approved the use of this phosphogypsum in road construction. And that's, as we've been talking about, a waste product of the phosphate mining. It contains radioactive isotopes of things like radium and uranium. But on Friday, a coalition of public health, environmental, and union groups sued the EPA for approving phosphogypsum in roads. Your group, the Center for Biological Diversity, is one of the groups that's suing the EPA. What has the EPA's expert consultant said about the cancer risks, for example, to people who are constructing these roads, about the genetic dangers or cancer risks of using phosphogypsum in road construction?
The EPA has long regarded phosphogypsum to present an unreasonable risk to public health. It has done that through a series of rulemakings beginning in the late 80s and early 90s, and found that in building roads that folks that are engaged in that activity can be exposed to levels of radiation that fall outside the acceptable range. And that hasn't changed. In fact, when the EPA most recently reviewed this issue again and hired its expert consultants, those consultants made the similar findings. This still presents an unacceptable risk to public health. And the risk is in the form of fatal cancer, and then you know, you kind of work backwards from there. Other forms of cancer, genetic damage, potential birth deformities. And the only thing that appears to be different in the EPA's calculus this time is the EPA has determined that it's comfortable with this level of risk now.
And this rule change by the EPA that you're talking about, it affects Florida in particular. It's not like we're going to see roads built necessarily in New Jersey or in Vermont, but that could happen in Florida. Why is that?
When the Fertilizer Institute, which is the group that requested this use, made its application, it said that it would only be economically feasible to use phosphogypsum as an amendment to road construction within 200 miles of a phosphogypsum stack. So if you look at Florida and where our phosphogypsum stacks are, and then you add on a 200-mile radius buffer to that, it covers the entire state. Likewise, Louisiana, Mississippi, and some areas out west will be similarly impacted. Although I would say that the biggest difference between Florida and those other states is that, I guess as a consequence of our own geography, I'm not entirely sure, our gypsum stacks seem to be more radioactive than other gypsum stacks located outside of Florida.
Our guest is Jacqueline Lopez with the Center for Biological Diversity. She's their Florida director, senior attorney. The Center for Biological Diversity is one of the groups that's suing the EPA because they approved phosphogypsum in road construction. And your groups are saying that it ought not, in addition to road people who are constructing the roads, the workers, it also might affect plants, animals, and their critical habitats. How would having radioactive phosphogypsum in the roads affect plants and animals?
Through the sedimentation and runoff are big concerns we have with having phosphogypsum in roads. Roads naturally on their own, absent any kind of catastrophe, break down just by being weathered, by being used. And as that material loosens and finds its way into our surface streams and groundwater, it has the potential for bioaccumulating up the food chain. So when the Fertilizer Institute made its application and the EPA hired a consultant to look at some of these exposure pathways, it looked at crayfish in particular and was alarmed by the potential for bioaccumulation in crayfish and anything that might eat crayfish, including people. There are about 450 or so endangered and threatened species that are within 200 miles of phosphogypsum stacks. When the federal government does anything, it spends money, it authorizes a permit, or it makes a decision, it has an obligation, it's required to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service for impacts to listed species, to determine whether or not there's going to be an impact on them, to see how these species that have already been determined to be very close to extinction might be further pushed further to that edge. And here the EPA has failed to do that. So one of the issues that we are concerned with is the potential for the radioactive properties. And it's not just that they're radioactive. They have significant amounts of sulfur, arsenic, barium, cadmium, chromium, copper, fluoride, lead, and zinc. So heavy metals and other trace metals that have demonstrated impacts, negative impacts to human health and to species in the environment at large.
The phosphate industry has to store this waste. And if it seems like, I mean, it would be a great way to get rid of your waste if you can sell it to companies that are making roads. Is that something that concerns you, that it's just kind of a way to almost hide where the waste is going rather than keep close tabs on it?
I think that is a concern of the EPA itself. When the EPA first determined it was necessary to keep phosphogypsum in stacks, it noted that because there's so much phosphogypsum being created and because it has such a high risk to people in the environment, that the best thing to do is to at least keep it in stacks so we know where it is, so that when there are sinkholes or other breaches, that there is a company directly responsible and hopefully financially resilient to take care of that, or to attempt to mitigate it. And specifically found that it would not be wise to scatter it throughout the United States as it has done so here. And notably, one of the groups that petitioned with us is a group that some of its members live less than a mile from a fossil gypsum stack in Louisiana. And the folks that live near that fossil gypsum stack say, well, we don't like living next to a fossil gypsum stack, but we certainly don't want it under our feet and expanding out through our state as well.
Our guest is Jacqueline Lopez with the Center for Biological Diversity. She's their Florida director and senior attorney, and they are one of the groups in a coalition of public health, environmental, and union groups who are suing the EPA for approving the use of phosphogypsum in roads. And you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. It's 12:21 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to Midpoint Monday. If you'd like to call in, you can call at 813-239-9663. You can also email us dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. And I'm going to go to a phone call right now, Jacqueline, if you don't mind. And this person, Chris, is calling from Clearwater, and he wants to ask about radioactive waste. Chris, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for the great show. You know, the underlying point is government does not care for the health of our life or any life, it seems, and these kinds of actions. And of course, I'd like to see folks realize that the phosphate mine fertilizer is obsolete. You know, most crops need just three minerals, P, N, K, potassium, nitrogen, phosphorus, to grow, to look good, but then their immunity suffers, so then they have that as a lame excuse to use pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides. It's called forced growth. And in order to make folks aware that phosphate mine fertilizer is obsolete, and I'll get on to talking about mitigating the radioactive waste with lasers. But
wrap it up really quickly, Chris, please.
Yeah, use ionized water because it's the mineral ions that you can just use. I have an at-home mineral water ionizer to ionize the minerals from Himalayan salt and Epsom salt, which is magnesium sulfate. Sprayed on the plants, they do much better. They can fend off the pests. They grow much bigger, bumper crops. Annuals turn into, and biennials turn into perennials, and have much better luck. And I've seen, you know, cannabis and other farmers using.
So, Chris, I'm going to cut you off there because I want to continue with our guest. But maybe Chris is leading us into a question about the necessity of phosphate fertilizer. Jacqueline, maybe you can address that. The phosphate industry certainly says it's necessary. It helps sells it to farmers, that is, around the world to create very healthy and vibrant crops. What's an alternative to using phosphate fertilizers?
I see a lot of parallels between the fertilizer industry and the oil and gas industry in this moment in time. And that is to say that 150 years ago, we had functioning society, we had people, we had jobs, everything, without massively produced fertilizer, without extreme dependence on oil and gas. And we are coming to the end of the era for both, not just because that's what people are demanding, although that is true, and not just because of the extreme environmental consequences as we're seeing, but also because they're finite resources. Oil and gas are finite, phosphate is finite. And so we had better be considering alternatives to conventional fertilizer as we know it right now, because it won't be around much longer, maybe a few more generations. And so the alternatives, everybody, of course, is aware of organic and how scalable that is. And I would just push back on the idea first of all, that it is necessary. We have demonstrated history that it's not necessary, or that it's our obligation to find another way for the fertilizer industry to be successful. But those pathways exist.
And before I let you go, is there anything else that people need to know about upcoming meetings about phosphate mining in Florida? Are there any counties that are currently considering it? What should our listeners know about phosphate in Florida?
There's one phosphate mine that is moving through an approval process up in Union and Bradford counties. So if you live up north or you have concerns up there, that's one to look out for. It's a smaller mine relative to the ones we have in West Central Florida. The other one is the big one that's down in DeSoto County, where the DeSoto County Commissioners had originally decided to not approve that, and then through mediation and threat of litigation, decided to change their mind and give 4 years. So the clock is running on that, and I think there's about 2 years left. So we can expect to see public meetings and hearings coming up and considering that renewed application for, I forget now if it's about 18,000 acre mine in DeSoto County.
Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much for coming with us, coming on the show today and talking about your lawsuit against the EPA for allowing the use of radioactive phosphogypsum in road construction. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Jacqueline Lopez, Florida Director and Senior Attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. And you're listening to WMNF 88.5 FM. And it's 12:26 in the afternoon. We're going to take a very short music break right now. Afterwards, we'll hear how mayors and county commissioners around the Tampa Bay area are enforcing COVID-19 safety rules. And we'll also take your calls, 813-239-9663. And that's all coming up after we hear just a bit of this new song by David Rovics. It's about the struggles faced by the working poor in Florida's tourist economy. It's called Cinderella.
Things have been getting worse for a very long while. Once upon a time, you could live in style. Whatever it was you did was a salary job. You could work this hard without feeling robbed. At the Magic Kingdom, I saw a vision that now I'll always know. When I saw Cinderella sleeping in her car on the streets of Orlando.
Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. It's 12:28 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan, and you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. And that's the beginning of a new song by David Rovics called Cinderella, about working poor in Florida and how they are so hard to survive based on the tourist economy. Well, we turn right now to our next topic, the efforts by local governments in the Tampa Bay area to slow the spread of coronavirus. Last Thursday, the chairs of the county commissions from the two largest counties in the Tampa Bay area, Hillsborough and Pinellas, as well as mayors of the three largest cities in those counties, Tampa, St. Petersburg, and Clearwater, held a Zoom meeting to talk about how they're enforcing COVID-19 safety rules. And I'm going to take your calls in just a minute as well. So if you're still holding because of the, you want to talk about phosphate, we can do that in a bit. I'm going to play a little bit of sound before we go back to the phone line. So Andrew in Hardy County, please hold on. Or you can call in right now, 813-239-9663 if you want to talk about phosphate or if you want to talk about COVID-19 safety rules in your community. Some of the things I'd like to know as you listen, think about these things. Do you think the state of Florida is doing enough to enact statewide rules for COVID-19 safety? What else could Florida be doing? And what about the local restrictions in your area? Do they go too far or not enough? So give us a call, 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. We're going to hear first from Tampa Mayor Jane Castor, and here's what she has to say about local community control of COVID-19 and how she's enforcing the COVID-19 rules.
We're bringing the leaders from Pinellas County and Hillsborough County, the cities of St. Petersburg and Clearwater and Tampa, here today to talk about the topic that is most important to our community, and that is COVID-19 and what we can do to try to reduce the numbers in this surge of COVID-19, the spike in cases that each of our communities are experiencing at this time right now. I believe that we have done an excellent job as a region in working together on a number of fronts, whether it's the community leaders, it's the community itself, the residents, the medical community, everyone coming together to do what we can to keep all of our residents safe. So I would like to start by thanking everyone for your partnership, your cooperation in what we have been able to do. I know that Dr. Michael from USF, many of you know him, he's a USF professor, an epidemiologist, and he does a lot of the projections associated with COVID-19. And he has indicated that as a region, that we have reduced or prevented approximately 1.4 million cases of COVID-19 by implementing the mask ordinance and having our communities collectively wear those facial coverings and practice safe social distancing in the last couple of months since the beginning of this pandemic. And so we do have a great community. We can reduce these numbers of COVID-19, but we need to continue doing that right now. As stated, we are in an incredible spike right at this moment. Also, COVID-19 doesn't know where a city ends and a county begins. And so that's even more of a reason for us all to come together and make sure that we can prevent this disease. We do have a vaccine. A lot of individuals believe that with the arrival of that vaccine, we don't have to take any further steps. That is not factual. We have got to continue wearing masks. We won't have the entire community vaccinated for a number of months. And so we've got to continue forward with these simple steps that will allow us to all stay safe. Now, we have, in the city of Tampa, have taken a number of steps to help out our small businesses, including our restaurants, bars, and retail. We have provided the tools necessary for them to be aware. We've provided signage for their businesses indicating what safety steps need to be taken. At the very beginning of the opening of restaurants and retail, we opened up our streets, allowed tents to be erected, whatever we could do to help the businesses get back up on their economic feet and do that responsibly and do that safely. And all of the information that we have can be found on tampagov.net. And we really did well in the very beginning. We passed out over 500,000 masks just in the city of Tampa. And I know the other jurisdictions have made those masks available as well. But the few businesses that aren't being good citizens in the community have got to be addressed. So here in the city of Tampa, Hillsborough County BOCC, as many are aware, passed an amendment just yesterday that mirrors the one that's been in effect in Pinellas County. And that requires individuals to be seated while eating and drinking, and bans dance floors or loitering next to the bars. And you're gonna hear a lot more from Hillsborough County Commissioner Pat Kemp and also Pinellas County Commissioner Pat Girard about their particular ordinances. That Hillsborough County ordinance is effective in the city of Tampa as well. So we will be enforcing that as of this evening. We have been warning those bad actors in the city of Tampa since March. We went out last weekend again and provided warnings and provided the necessary signage, whatever the bars or restaurants needed to be able to act safely and responsibly. So we are going to have our code enforcement out this evening. They'll be enforcing that Hillsborough County ordinance, and they'll also be enforcing the City of Tampa's mask ordinance. Civil infraction up to $500 fine or a second degree misdemeanor. And that will be for those repeat offenders. So we are counting on the businesses. We're also counting on our residents to understand and take seriously their level of personal responsibility and ensure that they aren't holding these events that in essence are super spreaders. So we want to make sure everyone has a very safe holiday season and they don't begin the new year with COVID and possibly in the hospital, and even worse in cases where individuals are losing their lives in our community.
Well, that is Tampa Mayor Jane Castor speaking about how her city enforces COVID-19 safety measures. What do you think? The number is 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org. If you'd like to text, please sign your name and text us at 813-433-0885. It's 12:36 in the afternoon, and you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm going to read a couple of emails, then I'm going to go to the phone line, so please be patient if you're on the line. This is from David in Clearwater. He says, twice within the last month when I spoke out to people in checkout lines without a mask on, a cashier at Dollar Tree and a customer service manager at Walmart told me they're not permitted to speak to the person about their failure to wear a mask. How are you supposed to feel a semblance of safety when stores won't enforce their mask requirement? And, you know, you're talking about stores in Clearwater, so the Pinellas County Sheriff has said that he will crack down on stores that don't enforce that. So he gave a number to call. I can't remember right now what it is. I'm sure you could find it on the Pinellas County Sheriff's website. But it is the responsibility of the business owners, if they don't want to get fined or worse, if to enforce that their customers are wearing masks or they have to be turned away. So thanks for that email, David. Also, I'd like to read an email from Hemp Hemp Hooray, does not sign her name or his name. Writes, is phosphorus lighting also used in the military industrial complex to create depleted uranium and other balls? Another reason why we overproduce and try to get the byproducts of the fertilizer industry. Gosh, I have to tell you, I do not know anything about how you create depleted uranium and whether the phosphate industry is involved. That's just something I don't know. I know that military uses white phosphorus, but also how that happens, how they produce that, I don't know. And as a March Against Monsanto activist, this directly correlates genetically modified food industry, says this emailer, Hemp Hemp Hooray. Mosaic, which is under the parent company Monsanto, don't know if that's true, says, oh, now Bayer, is responsible for all these chemicals and the overuse of chemicals being used. And this directly correlates to the algae blooms and creating dead zones in the oceans and the waters around Florida. This needs to be stopped. So that's an email from Hemp Hemp Hooray. I don't know if Monsanto and Bayer Mosaic and Bayer are related. I apologize for not knowing that. I don't think they are. But it's true that the more phosphate fertilizer that gets into the oceans, the worse the dead zones are and the worse the algae blooms are, because the algae consume the phosphate, which is often a limiting nutrient, as is nitrogen. Nitrogen is often also a limiting nutrient in the Gulf of Mexico. All right, so thanks for those emails. We are going to go now to the phones. Let's hear from Shannon in Hernando County. Shannon, what can you tell us about how people are adhering, that is the word I was looking for, to the mask requirements in Hernando County, or are there any?
Not very well. I work for a grocery store chain, and we as employees are required to wear a mask, but quite a lot of the customers are refusing to wear them, and we have free masks to give them, but sometimes they're quite hostile. We get cussed out on occasion, even for just offering a mask.
So that's, I don't know. I've seen this reaction either on video or maybe I've seen it in person, but I've definitely heard from our listeners saying things like that, where people have such a strong reaction about this. Is there anything else? Like, is there, when you run out of an item that's on sale, do people curse you out? I just don't understand the connection between why people get so upset about this. Okay. So it's not just masks. Okay.
It's not just that, but it's been so politicized that there's a lot more read into it. Not everybody reacts that way, but when you have younger people at the front of the doors, I think they're hesitant to even offer a mask to someone without them because they're afraid of confrontation.
All right. Well, I appreciate you calling in, Shannon. Is there anything else before we move on that you'd like to say?
No, thanks so much for your show.
All right, thank you. Thank you for calling in. And the number again is 813-239-9663. You can call or you can email DJ at WMNF.org. Let's hear right now from Mike in Sarasota. Hi, Mike. How is it looking in Sarasota?
Good afternoon, Sean. Thanks for taking my call. I can't really tell you that much about Sarasota. What I can tell you is this. I have been tracking the numbers on the statewide level coming out of the Florida Department of Health for 275 days now. And I've been producing, you know, like the curves of cases and fatalities and hospitalizations. And I used to put these up on the WMNF bulletin board page until you adopted the new policy where people can't do that. Only staff members can. And I don't have, you know, I understand that, staffing restrictions. What I wanted to comment about, though, is this. You will hear, and I saw articles in today's newspaper, that cases of COVID are reaching new highs. We're experiencing a surge in confirmed cases. But now here's an interesting fact about those cases. Those are confirmed cases from people who have self-selected to be tested. We, on the state level and on the national level, we do not have a precise idea how many actual real cases there are. We know the numbers of cases from people who have gone in to get tested, but that's going to be a fraction of the actual number of cases that are out there. Now, some people say that it could be that the number of real cases might be as much as 10 times the number of cases from people who've gone in and actually gone through testing. And you'll hear all kinds of other estimates. So here's what I would recommend as a policy move to address this, because this is a real problem. If we don't know actually how many people have these cases, we're kind of blindly trying to solve the problem. The answer to knowing how many real cases there are would be some kind of random sample of the population. Now, this could work. Now, if this were in Florida, what it would mean is we might find, say, 10,000 people or something like that. And they would have been pre-selected before the pandemic, perhaps, or maybe they can be selected now. And we just, because they're random, it's a random sample, we test them. And then that would, through the magic of statistics, we would be able to tell, we would have a very good, you know, within, say, 5% margin of error or something like that, have a very good idea how many real cases there are in Florida. And you can do the same thing nationally. But what we need is that random sample. So if I were Governor DeSantis, that's one of the first things I would do is get my Department of Health to go out and get a random sample of Floridians. Now, how you get that, I mean, I'll have to leave that up to you know, epidemiologists and biostatisticians, et cetera.
All right. Hey, Mike, I get where you're going. What do you think? I mean, it's kind of an obvious, but if that happened, let's say Governor DeSantis did that, how would his state look all of a sudden if you started to randomly sample Floridians who weren't self-selecting, as you put it, to go get tested? Wouldn't it make Ron DeSantis look like an utter failure because the numbers would shoot up?
I think it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing. Or I think, you know, there are negative, sure, possible ramifications that if we did come out with statistics which show that the number of real cases was much higher than what we've been talking about. On the other hand, politically, I think it would give DeSantis a chance to catch some good publicity because he could say, look, I'm seriously addressing this thing. I'm not relying on you know, questionable statistics. We're going out and getting real statistics. And who knows? I mean, you know, beyond that, all, you know, what the other ramifications would be if we as Floridians actually knew what, you know, how many people actually had the COVID virus, and also more importantly, which populations, you know, were having it in larger or smaller amounts, then, you know, like then we might be able to address the whole situation more effectively. For instance, we think right now that school children don't get it very much, but from a random sample, we might find differently, and then we would be able to target health efforts at school children.
All right, I'm going to move on, Mike, but I appreciate those thoughts, and it's something we've been hearing ever since the beginning of the pandemic, that more testing is better. So something like that certainly you know, would give us a better picture of how the pandemic is spreading. So thank you for those thoughts, Mike, in Sarasota. I appreciate that. Let me read a text before I go back to the phone lines, which are full right now, but we're going to clear up a line or two in just a second. 813 didn't sign their text. and says, the mask thing has become like a religion, like all questions about if they're really effective, and we must not question our new high priests, our scientists. So this sounds like someone who is a little bit skeptical of masks and skeptical of science, it sounds like. I have to read into it because I'm just getting a couple of lines of text here, unsigned. So thank you for that text. Let's go to, you know what, I'm going to do this. We're going to come back to COVID-19 in just a second, but Andrew in Hardy County has been very patient. He's been waiting on the line for a long time to talk about phosphate. So, hi, welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Sean. First, let's clear up a couple of factuals. There were questions that were raised just in the last few minutes. One, on depleted uranium. Depleted uranium is a product of processing uranium ore to extract fissionable material, specifically U-235, most of what is in what's left over is U-238, which is also a feedstock for fast breeder reactor plutonium production. But there are several other isotopes of uranium in there, and it's basically just the leftovers from fuel processing
to the point of our conversation. Uranium mining isn't happening here. It's phosphate mining, and so they're not really connected is probably what you're getting at.
Well, no, what I'm actually getting at is just the facts in the matter that the guy what was being discussed is essentially, you know, is depleted uranium coming from phosphate? And the answer is, in general, no. And the use for depleted uranium is primarily in armament, because it's used as armor, which came about as a result of the creation and production of artillery shells that use depleted uranium because of its density as an armor-piercing technology. So the reason I started putting those blocks of depleted uranium on tanks and Humvees and other military vehicles was to block incoming shells, which actually also contain depleted uranium. And another body of depleted uranium is pretty much the only thing that will stop them. Then on the question of, what's the other one? About business relationships. No, Mosaic is not part of any other organization. It's a freestanding, publicly traded corporation that's traded on New York Stock Exchange under the ticker symbol MOS. It's not related to Bayer or any other chemical production organization. Now, to get around to my original reason for calling, Ms. Lopez and the founder of her organization, Kieran Suckling, are doing a disservice to a lot of more straight-up environmentally conscious organizations. And what we got from Ms. Lopez today was essentially a narrative which leans strongly in the direction of trying to convince people that they are in danger from something from which they're not in very much danger at all. And there are much more dangerous radiologic sources that we really need to be paying attention to. Phosphogypsum has as a primary contained component the residual radium in the process. The residual uranium actually goes with the phosphorus. So you've actually got those two radionuclides going in two opposite directions in the process. The radium goes with the gypsum, but uranium travels the same path as the phosphorus in the process of processing it out, as she indicated, mostly to make fertilizer, but there are other.
But I think the point is, Andrew, and is that the waste that's left over, the phosphogypsum, is more radioactivity than background radiation.
Well, I'm not actually sure about whether the gyp stacks are above background or not. They're not much. But the other scare phrase is radon. And just for purposes of understanding, since radon is a decay daughter of radium, which is one of the heaviest of all naturally occurring elements, radon is also an extremely heavy nucleus. And if you and your listeners would like to know what it actually takes to authoritatively and permanently block the movement of a radon nucleus through matter, I'd be happy to share with you and with them that it takes 15 mils of polyethylene sheeting. So a sheet of visqueen is actually overkill to stop radon simply because it is such a large nucleus. and it cannot easily pass through other forms of matter, even polyethylene. So that's why they put down in areas around Florida where there's construction going on, housing construction, any kind of residential construction, commercial construction, you'll see sheets of high-density PE being put down in the soil as a part of the construction process to block the movement of radon into structures that can be occupied by human beings. And that's all it takes.
Right. I appreciate that, all that information, Andrew. I think it's we're getting kind of deep in the weeds, but I do want to appreciate a alternative perspective. So thank you for that. And we're probably going to go back to the COVID-19 discussion because it looks like that's what people want to talk about right now. And so Tommy is in St. Petersburg. Hi, Tommy. Welcome to the show. What would you like to talk about in St. Pete about wearing masks?
I was at my local Winn-Dixie recently, and there was a couple in line behind me not wearing masks. And I asked them, why is it always, and I'm a blonde-haired, blue-eyed white guy, and I asked them, why is it always ignorant white people, mostly ignorant white people, who don't ever wear masks? And the woman said, I can't breathe in the thing. And I'm sorry, but if you can't breathe in a mask, you really don't have any business being out in public during a pandemic. And that's all I really have to say.
All right. Thank you for that, Tommy. And I've heard responses from surgeons who have to wear, you know, for like a 7-hour surgery, they have to wear a mask the whole time. And they don't have very much, in the ones I've read, they don't have very much empathy for the people who say they can't wear a mask at a grocery store. So thank you for that. Let's hear from Richard in Tampa. Hi, Richard. What would you like to say?
Hey, Sean. How you doing? Just want to clarify. People used to wear chemical masks for years. World War One, World War Two, Korea, Vietnam. Those masks were made to protect you from all kinds of chemical warfare that was, and germ warfare that was being used on you in the field. So masks are protective gear. It's masks are very good. And hopefully masks will help solve this thing. But another new twist has been added to this where we really don't know where the end is what's happened over in Britain. And now they've been locked down and they're saying there's some kind of mutant strand to do with this virus that's like 20% stronger or 17% stronger than, I heard this on the NBC News, Good Morning show this morning. And, that sounds a little bit, you know, a little bit of uncertainty there. That's why there's a lot of skepticism there. So what do you think?
Well, here's what I know. And again, as we heard last hour, this is a really kind of a brand new development. There has been a variant of the virus. Naturally, that happens. The RNA mutates. It's a natural thing that happens all the time. And this variant, which is spreading rapidly in the south of England, London and the rest of the south, it seems to spread more easily, something like 70% more easily. And one of the, I think the mutations are on the protein, the coat protein of this virus. And so you think, oh, wait a second, the coat protein is what is targeted by the vaccine, at least the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine. So, oh no, maybe the vaccines wouldn't be effective against this variant. But one thing I read, and of course I can't find it right now, but one thing I did read this morning said that the vaccine targets so much of this part of this coat protein that even if a little bit of it changed and is changed in this variant, it still is likely, of course we don't know, but it's still likely that the two vaccines that are out right now would be effective against this mutated virus. So that's what I heard. Of course, I can't find the source right now, but that's what I've been hearing, and we'll know more.
They broke history, which, you know, they've never created vaccines like this ever this fast. I mean, it usually takes years and years and years to develop types of vaccines like her that are being used to solve this problem. So there's some uncertainty to that. I'd like to make one little comment about our local mayor and our local jurisdictions. Let's not toot our horns and let's not pat everybody on the back and say, hey, we're doing the best and the best and the best and we've done all this. We got to keep the foot on the gas pedal till the end. till this thing really starts reversing itself. So we need to try harder and harder and harder and do better and better and better. And code enforcement should have been enforcing a lot of these restrictions and everything a long time ago. And they were talking about in March, they've been warning these people, well, where are we now? We're in December. So a lot of these businesses and everything have been getting away with bloody murder. And it really comes down to bad behavior. If everybody behaved properly and just wanted to listen to what people were trying to tell you to try to help you and not hurt you, we will make this thing go away in the long run. Hopefully everybody stays safe through this holiday, and God bless. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Richard. Happy holidays to you. Happy solstice. I'm really, you know, it's so simple. We've been told a million times, please wear a mask if you go out, especially if you're going to be indoors and especially if you're going to be close to people. Stay away from people if you can. Social distance. Don't go to gatherings. Don't go to Thanksgiving. Don't go to Christmas. Celebrate with your household. And wash your hands. I mean, we've been told that over and over and over, and none of these are major, you know, difficulties. I mean, it's sad to not be with your extended family at Christmas. That's sad. But as they said at Thanksgiving, better a Zoom Thanksgiving than a funeral Christmas. They probably put it better than I just did, but they. So, you know, it's just really simple stuff. The vaccine is expensive and it's difficult, but it's going to help as well. But all these other things are so simple that we can just do. So please, come on, do your part. Hey, all right, thanks for that call, Richard. Let's go now to Marsha in Brandon. Hi, Marsha. What would you like to say on 88.5 FM?
Yeah, hey, good day. I just wanted to say about people who say that they can't breathe when they're wearing a mask. It is a little difficult with a cloth mask, but what I did was switch to the paper blue mask, which is actually better protection. And it's a lot better as far as breathing, and you don't have any problems with it at all. So maybe people should just switch to the better protective mask. And that's all I wanted to say. So happy holidays. Merry Christmas to everybody.
Happy holidays to you, Marsha. Happy Festivus. I appreciate all the people who called in today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give the credits right now so that we can listen to more of this David Rovick song. I just think it's really appropriate for the holidays that we think about our low-income neighbors who are working their butts off in the tourism industry that sustains this state. And a lot of them are having real financial difficulties, especially with COVID. So I want to thank all the people who called and emailed and texted today, and thanks to DT and Frank Knox. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. I'll be out next Monday, but I hope you can join us the following Monday, Monday, January 4th, 2021. My guest will be Congressmember Kathy Castor. We're going to talk then about the latest coronavirus news, what's next for COVID-19 relief, and what might happen when Congress counts electoral college votes that week. So I hope you can join us at noon on January 4th. Stay tuned now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Here is a new song from David Rovick.
Things have been getting worse for a very long while. Once upon a time, you could live in style. Whatever it was you did was a salary job. You could work this hard without feeling robbed. At the Magic Kingdom, I saw a vision that now I'll always know. When I saw Cinderella sleeping in her car on the streets of Orlando. Over the years, the smile's getting thinner. No longer the faces of breadwinners. All those families eating in hotels. Once we could afford to do that sort of thing as well. Now we can't afford to stay can't afford to go. And Cinderella's sleeping in her car on the streets of Orlando.
Cinderella by David Rovics. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland.